Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, the director of a comedy improv show for adults, but with puppets. Then one of the top manga artists from Japan is coming to the D. Young Museum, and a prodigy comes back to the Bay Area to perform with the California Symphony. Today's show is about raunchy puppets, a horror icon, and classical music. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. I have a confession to make. I love watching puppets making adult jokes. It cracks me up. Well, the comedy festival SF Sketchfest kicks off this week, and one of the funny shows on the lineup is Puppet Up Uncensored. These puppets are very much behaving badly and saying naughty things. The puppeteers are from Jim Henson's company. Patrick Bristow is the host, director, and co-founder of Puppet Up Uncensored, and there will be two Puppet Up shows this Saturday, January 17th, at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater in San Francisco. And joining me to talk about this very funny show that as today actually feels like a Puppet Up right now because we've been having some issues.
Just enough chaos to keep you on your toes, right?
Said, this feels like the Muppet Show. You guys don't know what's been going on behind the scenes, but it's been feeling very much like the Muppet Show, but with adults. But anyway, welcome, Patrick.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here. You brought your fun energy here. You had me cracking up before we even started. You know, you're very respected for performing improv, and you teach improv, and I have so much respect for comedians because that is not an easy art form, you know, and that's not easy what you do. What drew you to the artistry of improv? And I love improv.
Well, I think what initially, drew me to it was, first, I wanted to be a performer and actor. Mm-hmm. And then when I realized that there were forms that you didn't have to memorize anything, where you could be your own creator and interpreter at the same exact moment, that was very thrilling to me. And also, growing up, I was a terrible liar as a child. So I had a lot of practice making stuff up. So it was just seemed like the logical confluence of dysfunction and skill.
I love it. How did you become involved with Puppet Up Uncensored?
Well, I was with LA's Groundlings comedy troupe for many years. I was in the main company there. I taught and directed as well. And through a mutual friend of Brian Henson's and his wife, Mia Sara, I was introduced, and he said, well, you know, would you want to teach a couple classes for the puppeteers to help them just kind of loosen up their performance and, you know, maybe occasionally go off book and everything like that? And I said, well, sure. Well, you know, and the puppeteers were so instantly wonderful at it. And we just had to adapt some of the aspects of improv to the limitations and the gifts of the puppetry technique so that the two could, you know, coexist. And you know, I did my first like several weeks, and he said, do you want to keep doing it? I went, yeah. And then a few months later, I said, you know, it would really benefit them to do a little casual performance. And so Brian said, okay. And he set up our first performance, and it was not casual. 200 invited guests.
Oh my goodness.
In industry, bleachers, ushers. I'm like, what? You know, I was thinking like at lunch, you know, bring your brown bag lunch.
Right.
In the parking lot, in the corner, we'll do something now.
I mean, he is Jim Henson's son.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't do anything by half measures, Brian. he goes all the way.
I can see that. Wow. I would feel, were you a little intimidated? You must have been.
What, by Brian himself?
Or just by, like, you know, he was making it sound like it was going to be a small-scale thing, but small-scale thing to him is 200 people.
Oh, right, right. No, I had been through enough professionally that, you know, to expect the unexpected.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And was I intimidated by Brian? A little bit, but I would never let him know that. My whole act with him is to act like I'm completely unintimidated. And I've been doing that for now 20 years. So if he hears this, the jig is up and I'm in trouble.
I was going to say, I was like, if he's listening, yeah, he might know.
He might be.
Yeah, well, how is it working with him as far as, you know, not necessarily him as, you know, as being related to Jim Henson, but just as artists, as creators? Oh. Because, I mean, the comedy that you guys are doing is...
It's a lot of fun. He's a great collaborator. He and I both have very similar kind of mischievous senses of humor, as did his father. But, you know, you don't see a lot of the real Jim Henson humor, mm-hmm, if you're looking at Sesame Street or the family entertainment stuff, because that's what he did, you know, and he was fabulous at it. He recreated it. But even before that, he was doing these surreal, interesting, dark, weird things on TV with puppets years before Sesame Street and years before the Muppets, proper.
Yeah.
You know, like revolutionary stuff.
Yeah.
Like Ernest Kovacs level, just like genius.
Yeah, I was about to say, this is not a Sesame Street puppet show. So this is definitely for adults. But, you know, it's funny, looking back, now that I'm an adult and watching some of the old, I love the Muppet Show, and watching some of the old Muppet Shows episodes or movies, I could see little hints of things. Yeah. I mean, just Kermit and Miss Piggy's relationship.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that's not exact. That's not children's theater,
no,
really.
No, it's not. It's not. Looking back. Yeah, when you look back.
Between the lines, you know what's going on.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think Jim's thing was intelligent nonsense, you know? And it kind of sums it up, because it's not like we're making references to the Punic Wars or being like smarty pants. But there is something that requires you to kind of like make some connections. And that makes you a participant watching puppet comedy.
Yeah.
Because you're translating it instantly, intuitively into human and your own experience in your own world. And that makes it a very fun, I think, form. Now, our show, we don't endeavor to go out there and be blue and use swear words and stuff. We just reserve the right to give the audience what they're wanting. And if they want to see an acrimonious, ugly divorce scene between our salmon puppet and, you know, one that we have that's shaped like a rhododendron flower.
Oh my
then
gosh.
Guess what? You're going to see an acrimonious, terrible, ugly divorce scene between a flower and a fish. It's going to happen. And we're not going to hold back.
I've just seen little samples, and it's funny. And I love what you said, how sometimes you're watching it and you're seeing these puppets, but then, and they're doing, you know, it's translating to like adult behavior. And it's something about that just really hits your humor. So I want to play a clip, but let me set the clip up. So here's an example of a puppet up sketch. And by the way, their theme song is hilarious. We couldn't play all of it, but puppet up sounds like something, something up, mess it up, you know, fill in the words. You know what I mean?
Figure it out.
Yeah, again, there you go. They'll figure it out. There you go. Okay. So in this sketch, the puppet is an elderly woman with wavy hair, glasses, and thick eyebrows. And there's a cute little scarf tied around her neck. We've all seen old ladies like this, you know, grandma, auntie. We've seen ladies like this. So she's in her living room by the fireplace. Patrick's like, what am I talking about?
I can't wait to see this.
It's on Instagram. Okay. And so she's talking to her lover, Marty, on her house phone, because of course she grandma, she got a house phone, or auntie. All right, so let's take a listen.
Oh yeah? Well, what else you planning on doing to this naughty little... Oh, hang on, Marty, I gotta take this. Yeah. Hello? Oh, Mrs. Claus, what a pleasant surprise. What? You have a special Christmas present for me and Marty? Two tickets to Puppet Up? Playing for two shows only on Saturday, January 17th at Sketch Fest. Uh-huh. Oh. Is it raunchy?
Oh,
I love it. Thank you, Mrs. Claus. Oh, my goodness. Marty, guess what? We're going to pump it up.
I'd never heard that commercial that they did. That was the fabulously talented Donna Kimball doing the voice of the lady, and she will be in the show. But what we do are mostly improv. So if the audience says what they want to see, we make up that sketch on the spot. And one of the great things about our show is it's two shows in one. you can look up at these two giant screens and you'll see the puppets, you know, the way you're used to seeing them, like from about like their mid torso up.
Right.
But you also just avert your eyes down to the actual stage and you see the puppeteers manipulating them. You see how they do it. You see how they interact with each other. And so you get two shows in one.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes, you know, and it's just very natural how people's eyes go from the actual stage to the screen, depending on what is grabbing them at that moment. So that's a lot of fun.
If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with actor and director Patrick Bristow. He is the host of Pup It Up Uncensored, which is part of SF Sketchfest. And there will be two shows this Saturday, January 17th, at the Palace of Fine Arts. And this show is for adults. This is not Snuffleupagus and Big Bird. No.
Leave the kids at home. I think, like, you know, if you're a household that is, you know, I don't know, a little bit free, or maybe you're 14-year-olds, you know,
okay.
Income. But there will probably be some language or topics or subject matter that, yeah, isn't right for the younger ones.
Okay. And forgive listeners for my sniffles. I'm dealing with allergies. I know this is the second week you've been hearing me congested. So I appreciate that you still staying with me. Did you ever wonder, like, is this going to work when you guys came up with this?
Oh, yes. In fact, the first thing we did wasn't really a show. It was a demonstration. It was like, hey, everybody, guess what? We're doing some puppets and improv at the same time. What? And they came and watched. And then people were like, oh, this is a show. You should take it to festivals. And festivals invited us. We went to Aspen. Then we went to Edinburgh. And then we went to Sydney. And the show has developed over the years so that it's improv comedy, but it's also old Jim Henson routines from the 50s.
Wow.
That haven't been seen by live audiences since then, that we've recreated, and some original content and music, song improv, a couple things that involve the audience a little bit more. And it's a very complete evening. So it's not just going to an improv show with puppets. It's a whole variety show with improv and those fantastic Henson puppets.
Oh.
And we're going to be at 5 o'clock and 9 o'clock.
Okay. So people have two options of shows to go to. Or, hey, I mean, it's improv, so no show isn't the same, right? So.
No, yeah. Even though, like, the bones of the show might be the same, it changes every single time. And that's why, as a host, I have to, like, kind of, I can't phone it in because things are shifting too quickly around me.
Right.
And, yeah.
And so you're not a puppeteer, right? Just for clarity. So you're not a puppeteer. You're hosting. Yeah.
No, I tried it just for, you know, fun. It's really hard because one of the things people don't realize about Henson-style puppeteering is when it was developed for camera, right, their puppets, if I turn my puppet to my physical left, on the camera, I'm going to see it move to the right because they didn't flip images back then.
Oh.
So all of the classic Muppeteers are trained that left is right, right is left. They've built these crazy synaptic highways between the hemispheres of their brains. And even current new puppeteers are trained in the old school, left is right, right is left.
Oh,
and
wow.
That is crazy.
That is. Wow. Yeah, it's very physical. It's not, that's why I said, you know, I mean, improv is not easy, and definitely doing puppeteering is not easy. It's very, very physical. I've seen documentaries where they do it. And it's not easy. What makes good improv? I mean, aside from making people laugh, but what makes good improv? Because people come to you, you're one of the best in the industry with teaching this and doing improv. That's what I read online. You're one of the best.
My family told you that.
Is that what they said? Okay. I'm figuring you must be good because basically who you work for. And I've seen you too on television as well. So you're very funny. But what makes good improv?
You know, in a nutshell, I would say, being able to be relaxed under any kind of pressure and distraction and be present and be honest. If somebody is really just being present, honest, and relaxed and allowing their reactions to occur based on what their partner is doing or saying or not doing or saying, whatever the truth is right in front of them, that can be fascinating, whether it's hilarious or just kind of watchable. It's fascinating. So the person who's really trying hard to be funny, might not work. The person does a bunch of jokes, we might feel there's a truth behind there that we really want to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So. Okay. And you've been on Whose Line Is It Anyway, right? Have you?
Yes, I did two episodes of that.
Okay, because I was like, Patrick, also, I just wanted to just give a little more background. You've been on Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm. We talked earlier, before the show, you were on Ellen, the sitcom. So, yeah, we've seen you. You've done a lot.
The young me that decided he wanted to get into acting got to do some stuff that he wanted to do.
Yeah.
So, good for him.
You know, it's when you can live your dream, that's a blessing. That's a blessing.
Yeah, I really just love doing Puppet Up, and I love teaching. And, you know, when I get to act, that's fun too. But mostly it's, I'm into the process of watching what the moment reveals.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this show sounds great. I'm so happy that you're doing it. I really, like, I used to watch Crank Anchors. I like raunchy puppets, so that's a Janae thing. That's Patrick looked at me like, ooh, okay, I told too much about myself. Thank you so much, Patrick, for coming on.
You can't talk enough about yourself. I could just hear. I'll interview you next time.
Yes, next time. Next time. You definitely have to come back. Thank you so much, Patrick. Thank you for taking the time. Right. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you all.
Yes, yes. Have a good one. Patrick Bristow is the director and host of Puppet Up Uncensored, which is part of SF Sketchfest, and it's happening twice. They have two shows on Saturday, January 17th, and we'll have all the details and a link on our website. Okay, coming up. Ooh, that music is good. One of the biggest comic horror artists from Japan sold out tickets to his San Francisco talk in minutes. We'll hear why comic book fans in the Bay Area are so excited. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. The De Young Museum in San Francisco is hosting an event that has manga fans so excited, tickets sold out in under 10 minutes. Again, manga is a Japanese style of comic books, and this event is a discussion with manga artist Ito Junji. Mr. Ito is one of Japan's most famous horror manga creators, and he's been drawing and writing horror since the 1980s. Now, according to the De Young's website, his work has shaped horror in various mediums of Japanese pop culture, and he has a lot of fans here in the U.S., and here to explain the fascination with his work is Nicole Coolidge-Rumanier. She is a scholar and curator of the Art of Manga exhibition at the De Young Museum. Hi, Nicole.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Yes, I'm so happy. So I interviewed you in the fall, in October, and now we get to see, we were remote, so now we get to see each other in person. So it's good to see you and actually meet you.
Wait, I can't tell you that since we last talked, the exhibition has been packed. It's been really exciting. And do you know what I've seen? I've seen people actually cry in front of the artwork.
Really?
It's they get so emotional. They get so swept up. And Ito Junji definitely personifies this, but people really identify with the characters. It becomes part of their makeup, part of their lives. And that's what's so exciting about seeing it in the flesh.
Okay, because I remember, you know, when I talked to you, you love manga. So in my head, you're the manga lady.
I do. I admit it. Guilty as charged.
I said, man, she loves manga. But hey, you know, but that's good. You get to do what you're passionate about. Okay, so just to remind people, so this is the first major exhibition of manga in North America. Again, manga, because some people were asking me, particularly my family members, they still didn't get it. I was like, manga is Japanese style of comics.
Yes.
All right. And Nicole is a professor of Japanese art and culture at the University of East Anglia, Norwich in the UK.
Yes.
Okay. So I just want to give that background. So she knows what she's talking about. Okay. But today we're going to talk a bit about Ito Junji. Okay. So what is so special? And did I say his name right?
Perfectly.
Okay. Thank you. Because she is a professor and I want to get a good grade at the end of this discussion.
So far, so good.
Okay. So what is so special about his horror? I mean, he's I guess some people would say he's like a Stephen King in his country, but he's a global, you know, horror creator. I have looked at some of his work. So what is special about him, aside from scaring the bejeebies out of folks?
What is incredible about him is not just his stories, not just these kind of intricate ways he envisions things, but it's actually how he articulates it through his line, through how he draws it, the kind of the amazing detailed line quality, the composition that just draws you in and completely frightens you. It's it's not just so much what he's drawing, it's what he doesn't draw that you think is about to come in. Mm. And it's that unspoken sense. What happens a lot in Japanese manga, as opposed to American comics, is that it's about perception, expectation, and not showing the actual act of impact. So, for example, in comics, you might see if someone's being killed, you will see them being killed.
Okay.
In, you know, being shot, them bleeding, them falling mm-hmm. over. In Japan, in manga in general, it's the lead up to that, and then you see them on the ground.
Okay.
You don't see the shot going in. So you could, what happens is, and this goes in with the puppets that you had just a second ago, it's how this performance works in your mind. You become a participant. You're not just passively reading. You are actually part of this performative experience.
Okay.
You are experiencing it because you, if you see before this guy's going to get about to get shot, but you don't mm-hmm. see him shot, and then you see him falling over or her falling over,
uh-huh.
in your mind you have completed that action
okay.
and you have participated in it and you have bought into it and you viscerally feel it.
Interesting.
So
okay.
we have in the mm-hmm. exhibition, and mm-hmm. I want everyone to come in there, and I just wanted to mention that it's been so popular, we've been extended a week. So it's through February 1st,
mm-hmm.
and then there are late nights, and then there's a late night event next Thursday that's going to be fabulous. But so you still have a chance to come and see it. And we have Ito Junji's work that is a must-see because it is only there. It's not. It's a work he's going to release in a year and a half on Moby Dick.
Okay.
And what's
on Moby Dick?
On Moby Dick. And he's doing this, and it's doing what's really interesting. And we're doing this in part in the event that we're going to have on Saturday at the Diyang that's going to be live streamed on the Diyang and also Anime News Network.
Okay.
What's amazing about him is that he's hand drawn this incredible picture, but it's about Ahab, you know, this man like that's obsessed. He's lost his leg. He's obsessed with this white whale, Moby Dick, that he just wants to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he feels that this is his life mission and gets everyone involved. But what Ito Junji is juxtaposing is that it's not actually the whale. There is something connected deeper that is much more sinister, that is much more frightening, that's
okay.
happening under the ocean.
You all should see her facial expressions. You can't because her eyes are widening. She's moving her hands. I'm scared.
You will be scared.
I can see. You know, that's one thing. I don't consume a lot of horror. You know, we've covered horror quite a bit. Our producer, Porfiria Rangel, is a huge horror fan. But, you know, one of the thing I do like about horror is because you always want to know who really is the monster, what really is the monster. You know, sometimes the monster is not the monster that you see. Something that was Ooh. Interesting about him, well, many things that are interesting about him when I was looking him up, is that he went to dental school.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I'm
That's
like...
That's key.
Well, I was going to say, because a lot of people are afraid of the dentist. He studied dental technology, to be specific, and so he left that profession to pursue his artistry. How does his dental background...
It's essential.
Okay.
It's essential. And what's interesting is he worked as a dentist for 3 years. And so he physically did it. So there are a couple of things about that. First of all, the attention to detail
mm-hmm.
and his minute drawing. So when you look at the drawing that we have on display, but, you know, even in any of his work, like Uzumaki, when you look at his work and I have...
And then Uzumaki, for people who don't know, that is, like, that was the book that... That was his first big book, right? That really catapulted him?
His first big book was Tomie.
Okay.
But Uzumaki is the masterpiece. Uzumaki
okay.
is really... And Uzumaki in Japanese means spiral. And it's about...
Oh.
And what's really interesting about what you were saying before, and we'll get back to his dentistry but in a second, but just if you bear with me for a moment, what's so important is... I thought this was key. What you said is, you know, who is the perpetrator? Who is responsible? What is this? Uzumaki, the word Uzumaki means spiral. And it's about this one town, this tiny little town called Kurozu-cho on the coast. And everything is becoming spirals. And people become spirals. Like literally their hair becomes spirals. Their body becomes spirals. They're turning into spirals. They die and they become part of this kind of spiral. And the real culprit... when you, spoiler alert, okay?
Spoiler alert. Spoiler, you know, alert. I don't do spoiler alerts, okay. But.
Yeah, so turn your ears away now, yes. If you don't want to hear this. But the real culprit is an archaeological site that the town is built over, and there is a curse in the archaeological site. And Japanese Jomon period, I've studied it, mm-hmm. are these fantastic prehistoric pots from like about 5,000 BC, that are 3,000 BC, 5,000, 3,000 time of Stonehenge, that are in these amazing spirals.
Wow.
So he is correct. These are these spirals that were created in the Japanese prehistoric aesthetics. And he's juxtaposing that this town didn't take care of the site and the spirals are possessing the town.
Wow.
Okay. But the dental assistant, just quickly to finish that one, is the attention to detail. But not only that, maybe more importantly, is his horror is a lot of, it's cosmic horror, like Uzumaki, but it's also about body horror.
Okay.
It's very much about the body. And so when you study dentistry, you have to do the muscles. Mm-hmm. You have to know all the body musculature so he can really capture bodies twisted, bodies in pain, body anxiety.
And I saw an image of, he had like a woman, she was in her skin and she was looking at her body on the floor that was out of her skin, like that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And then
yes.
there's, in this book that you showed me, and say the title again?
Uzumaki.
I see a character whose tongue has turned into a slug.
Yes.
So yes. That's the kind of things that he does. Yes.
And so what's amazing about the tongue turning into a slug, he's actually talked about that. And this is when a man turns into a spiral himself.
So we see a man who's a spiral, a thick spiral, and then his tongue
is turned into
a slug. And gagging.
Ito Junji said when he was young, he would look at himself in the mirror and stick his tongue out, and he thought it looked like a slug.
Okay.
And so he started copying that.
I was reading that, you know, he takes his inspiration from real life. But hold on, let me remind folks who we're talking to and what this is about. All right, for people that's just tuning in, I'm chatting with Nicole Coolidge-Rumanier. She's a curator of the exhibition Art of Manga and is currently running at the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco. And lucky you, it has been extended to February 1st. And you can live stream the conversation with manga artist Ito Junji live this Saturday, January 17th, on the DeYoung's website. And we'll have a link on the KLW's Sights and Sounds page.
Can I mention one other thing?
Go ahead.
So what's really important about what's going to happen Saturday with Ito Junji is, well, it's going to be talking about him. We're also adding in his editors. And people, you know, might read manga, but they don't really know how it's produced. And how it's produced is not just Ito Junji. It's about his editor sitting with him, talking to him, saying, no, don't do this, do this. You know, and so it's really kind of a communal product. And so we're going to have his Japanese editor in conversation. And then we're going to have the localizers, mm-hmm. the American editors, Alvin Liu. And we're going to have Yen Press, the head editor from Yen Press, Juyon Lee. And she's going to be speaking about how manga is made for in English and made into English, and how the processes work and what changes, what doesn't, and what objects they choose, and really what made Ito Junji such a phenomena.
Okay, that's very interesting, because I did have a question in my mind about, I was going to ask you about that later, about as far as like the translation and how it is made here in the U.S. But I'm glad you brought up the U.S. because what's his popularity here? I mean, you all sold the tickets out in minutes. I know his show.
6 minutes.
6 minutes.
6 minutes.
6 minutes. So very quickly, the tickets sold before you even hit the post, right, on the website, the tickets were sold out. I understand that his art has been animated, so mm-hmm. he has animated shows on Netflix. Porfirio was telling me HBO. So what's his popularity like here in the U.S.?
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. He is probably the most popular manga artist, and his popularity is huge in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. His popularity is big in China, but it's particularly big also in France and in Europe, in Italy. He's won all of these different awards. He's won 4 Eisner Awards. I mean, he just really is huge. Interesting enough, he is popular in Japan, but he's probably more popular outside of Japan.
Okay.
And we would have had more of his work in the exhibition. I wanted to actually do a deep dive of him, of his work, and he agreed. And so we're all set to do that, to have him as an additional artist. But what happened then was, unbeknownst to him and me at that moment, that Asahi Shimbun, a Japanese newspaper group, had actually secured his drawings for an internal Japanese show. So mm-hmm. for the last 2 years, his work has been traveling around Japan, and he's becoming incredibly popular in Japan now, too, as a result. But it was first abroad and then in Japan.
Why wasn't he as popular in Japan at first, do you think? Or do you know?
I think in particular, Japan has a long horror history. And Umezu Kazuo, you know, is the star, and that's really Ito Junji's, you know, kind of teacher and mm-hmm. inspiration. Ito Junji had a number of different inspirations, but Japan has this long history of horror. So having another horror, I don't think people really looked at his work, and we didn't have that history of that graphic horror, visual horror. I mean, you have graphic, but not as much as Japan. So I think that it was more fresh here, and then when Japan realized that it was popular here, mm-hmm. they took another look and realized how fabulous it is.
Mm. How were you guys able to get him?
We were really lucky. Yeah. How we were able to get him is through his editor.
Okay.
So I became, I befriended his editor. He has this editor named Nakaguma Ichiro who's coming, and he's going to be speaking to us. And he's just a genius editor. He's just retiring right now, but he is a genius. And I worked with him on the British Museum manga exhibition, and I said, we have to have Ito Junji. And he said, I can get him for you. So what happened was...
And I know Nicole went for it. Because Nicole, let me tell you something. Nicole, a nice lady. But I can tell when Nicole wants something, she goes for it.
I'm tenacious.
Yes.
And another little full disclosure, I love cats. And he does horror manga of cats, too.
Oh, okay.
And so I had to meet him. He's got a great manga with Kodansha about his two cats and how his two cats like terrorize him and his wife. Anyway, they rule. But I just had to meet this person, so I was a little scared. And I went to Chiba Prefecture to this cafe near where he lives near the train station. Mm-hmm. And I was told to meet him, and I had an editor with me, hand holding my hand. And he was the most amazingly fabulous normal person. You just think, how could such a wonderful normal person have such a sick mind?
Oh yeah, because the stuff. I mean, the art is, you know, if you like horror, it is beautifully grotesque, and it's not like, and it's in black and white, so it's not like bloody or anything. And like you said, it leaves things up to the imagination. 30 seconds. I know. So, is there anything else you want folks to check out?
I really want them to come to the exhibition and see his work in person, because once you see it, you cannot unsee it. His drawing is second to none. It is exquisite. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the other works and you take whatever you want out of that. But having that experience of the hand-drawn work that belongs to him, all of the work there belongs to the artist, you're not going to see it again. Please come.
Okay. All right. Nicole, it is a pleasure. And I'm so happy I got to see you in person. I can't wait to talk to you after the show. Thank you so much. Nicole Coolidge-Rumineer is the curator of the Arts of Manga. The exhibition is currently running at the D. Young Museum in San Francisco until February 1st. So you got a little more extra time. And this Saturday, watch the conversation with manga artist Ito Junji live on the D. Young Museum's website. Next up, the California Symphony's upcoming concert has a special guest. Stay with us. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. That lovely music you hear is from cellist Nathan Chan, and he's playing Bach Prelude No. 1. Nathan was practically in diapers when his passion for classical music first bloomed, and I say this because there's a cute video of him as a toddler watching a classical music concert and pretending to conduct the orchestra with a chopstick. It is so cute. The Bay Area prodigy is now a grown man and a Juilliard alum. He's making me laugh right now. And he's assistant principal cello of the Seattle Symphony. We have that classy, Nathan. But you can see him perform at the California Symphony Concert, Schubert in Vienna. And that's happening at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek on January 24th and the 25th. And joining me is Nathan Chan, along with our friend, the maestro himself. That's why we also have to get classy, because the maestro is here, Donato Cabrera. Donato is the artistic and music director of the California Symphony. Welcome, gentlemen. Hey, you guys.
Hey. Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having us on.
I'm so happy you guys are here. I'm so happy. Donato's always good to see you. And Nathan, it's nice to meet you. I had fun chatting with you before the show. You both are professionals, very well respected professionals. But I understand, Donato, you mentor Nathan?
Well, by the time I became music director of the San Francisco Symphony Youth Orchestra in 2009, Nathan was already well on his way. He was, how old were you, Nathan, then? It was, you were a junior in high school or a sophomore in high school, thereabouts.
That sounds about right.
Already, we all of us knew Nathan was going to become Nathan. And so even at that time, and we performed a wonderful cello concerto back then as well, Shostakovich's Cello Concerto No. 1. But even at that point, I felt that Nathan was more of a colleague and musical friend than someone who I was mentoring. And it's always been an honor to work with Nathan. He brings such a wonderful spirit and joy to making music that it's infectious for everyone to be a part of that experience when Nathan plays his cello.
Nathan, what were your
Donato.
Oh, that was so sweet. Nathan, what were your impressions of Donato? You were a teenager and
yes, I was a rebellious little teenager in the San Francisco Symphony Youth Orchestra. And, you know, I really enjoyed working with Donato, and I still do. He has this gregarious presence on the podium, and he always invites everybody into his world. And he does it with a level of intensity because he really, really cares. He's such a passionate conductor, but also music educator. And yeah. I feel he's taken that that kind of richness of and vivacity of life with them to this day. And so we're so looking forward to collaborating for what will now be the third time we're playing a concerto together.
Yes.
This time with the California Symphony.
Okay. Real quick, Nathan, what drew you to the cello?
So my relationship with the cello began actually with the love of the double bass. You know, when you're kind of a young wee lad looking at an orchestra and you're looking around, the thing that most impressed me was the size of the double bass and, of course, the sound. Mm. When I was very young, my parents had these old laser discs, which were basically like giant DVDs of really famous orchestras with their incredible conductors. And of course, one of the greatest orchestras in the world, the Berlin Philharmonic, was being conducted by Herbert von Karajan. And they have a very famous recording of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, one of our classic pillars in the classical canon. And there's a moment in the first movement where the double basses go dom, bom. And the way the shot was lined up and that sound was just so extremely captivating. So I asked my parents, could I please play? I want to play that one, the double bass. But like I said, I was a wee lad, and I still am sort of a smaller.
Oh, my goodness, Nathan.
But your listeners will have to imagine I'm a 5'6" guy, not the biggest guy in the world. But my parents were very smart, and they said, you know, that might be a bit too big for you. So we took it down a notch, and we settled on the cello, and I've never looked back.
Okay. Nathan, if you can't tell, is an influencer and has millions and millions of followers. So he's very animated. So that's a great story, Nathan. Thank you. Okay, so let's talk about the show. Okay, it is Schubert in Vienna, correct? Did I say that?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
That's right. Schubert in Vienna, and the concept behind this show is the story of what was the musical impetus behind what made music popular in Vienna? Because back in the day, there were no ads, there was no social media, there were no billboards. And so what did opera companies and symphonies do back in the day to make something popular? And so they sent out the loudest instruments into the streets of Vienna, which were the clarinets, flutes, bassoons, and horns, to play excerpts from what was being played that night at the opera house. And that group became the reason why every high school, every middle school to this day has a band and an orchestra and a chorus. And I'm exploring that through these three pieces. Mozart's excerpt from Don Giovanni, played by this group of musical instruments, followed by Gulda's concerto for wind, for cello and wind orchestra. And the central group in the Gulda concerto plays off when they're not playing, well, you'll hear it in a minute, mm-hmm. when they're not playing music that sounds like it's from the 70s, they play folk songs that sound just like these early bands. And the last movement of the Gulda concerto is like a march.
Yeah.
And then on the second half of the program is Schubert's symphony, and every theme in that great symphony is introduced by one of those instruments.
Okay.
And those and that group is the highlight of this entire concert.
So I want to play Symphony Number 9, The Great. And and so this is a performance by the orchestra, and correct me, Donato, because Donato is my teacher. Is it Gewandhaus Orchestra? Is that
close, very close. It's the Leipzig, that's the name of the orchestra, the name of the city, Leipzig Gewandhaus, which is the name of the concert hall in Leipzig, and it's actually the oldest orchestra in the world.
Yes.
And Mendelssohn was the conductor, and Mendelssohn was the person who actually premiered this Schubert symphony long after Schubert had died, because it was never premiered in public while Schubert was alive. That's why I chose this recording.
And Schubert died very young. He died in his early 30s. So he did not live a long time, but he made an impact. All right, let's play a little bit of that. This is Symphony Number 9. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with conductor Donato Carrera and cellist Nathan Chan. They are both performing in the California Symphony Concert, Schubert in Vienna, and you can hear them, see them at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek on January 24th and the 25th. Donato, you have a big smile on your face. What's coming up for you after you heard that snippet?
Well, it's one of my favorite pieces, and it's actually one of the reasons I got into music. Somehow, you know, when you're a kid, you stumble upon things you don't even know that are truly life-changing. And I got a recording of this when I was, I think, 12 or 13. And I was listening to all types of music back then. Don't get me wrong. U2, you know, just everything mm-hmm. I was listening. And then this piece I heard, and I was, my main instrument through high school was the French horn. And the French horn actually starts this symphony. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever heard for my instrument. And it sort of carried me along. It this piece has always been a companion to me along the way. And this is the second time I'm conducting this piece. And I'm so, every time I hear it, even though I've heard it thousands of times now, I put that smile on my face that you're noticing.
Yeah, I could, it took you to a place. That's why I had to ask. And so it took you back in the day to that French horn. Is that your favorite instrument? I never asked you that. What's your favorite instrument?
You know, these days when I can't say I have a favorite instrument anymore, because, you know, every time I hear a famous oboe solo, for that brief moment, the oboe is my favorite instrument.
Yeah.
And when Nathan plays the cello, I think, gosh, I wish I had learned the cello instead of the French horn, because now that's my favorite instrument.
It's cello. It is a beautiful instrument. I've actually been enjoying listening to cello more. Okay. And yay. So the second piece of the program is called, say it again, it's cello concerto? Concerto?
Concerto. It's a cello concerto by this Austrian. He was really mostly known as a pianist, a very famous pianist throughout the second half of the 20th century. Friedrich Gulda was mm-hmm. his name. And what made him unique, many things, but he started to just be obsessed with jazz. He became a world-renowned pianist early on in the late 40s and 50s. But then he started going to jazz clubs after he would finish his, you know, famous Carnegie Hall recital. He'd hop pop up to a jazz club.
Yeah, I definitely hear that.
He became obsessed. Yeah, he became obsessed with playing jazz and improvising. And so this concerto, along with many other pieces that he composed, is such a perfect example of his nature to ingest all sounds and make them his own. And I think you're going to play the first minute from the first movement. It's just far out and groovy.
And Nathan, you're playing this, right?
That's correct.
Yes.
And just kind of along the same lines of Donato having a difficulty picking a favorite instrument, I think I feel similar in terms of genres of music. And what draws me to this piece so much is every movement is like a different genre of music.
Yes.
It's really not as congruous as one would expect in a typical concerto. And it allows me to really switch my brain in between different styles. And that's something I'm actually very passionate about, is you mentioned a little bit of the social media stuff. Definitely expanding genres is something that I think is so important for classical music, because it brings people into our world in a way that we can connect with something that they're perhaps more used to or familiar with. And I think this piece does a fantastic job of bringing people into a totally different style of music that people, I don't think, have ever heard before. So I'm
looking forward to this. Yeah, because we only have a couple minutes left. So sure. I want people to hear this, because Nathan's going to be jamming. I'll just say that much. All right. And this is from the first movement, and it's called Overture. And here's a version by German-French cellist Nicolas Alchetz. Okay, so first song, everybody was kind of laid back and swaying. And then the second song, everybody was bopping their heads and moving. And David, our board operator, he was jamming.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, so that's... I can't have... Nathan, I can't have you on here again, because you don't know how to act, Nathan. No, I'm just kidding. No, Nathan is so much fun. And Donato is always fun. Okay, you guys, we have a little bit of time. We have like about a minute left. Any last words? You guys heard a snippet of what to expect at this show. You want to tell people why they should experience this show? Anything else you want people to know about this upcoming concert?
Well, I think what makes California Symphony so special is what we're trying to do is take people on a journey so that they may be coming because they know of Mozart, or they know of Schubert, or they're friends of Nathan, and they may be coming there to support. But what my goal is to take them on this journey, to teach them something about why we make music the way we make music, even to this day. And I think telling that story is why it's so special, that live music is just, you can't compare that to anything else. It's that this curated evening or afternoon of music making will make you leave that concert hall a changed person and give you a little bit more insight into this wonderful world of the symphony orchestra.
Nathan, 5 seconds.
I just want to say thank you for a show. We had puppeteers and we had horror manga, and then we ended with some rock and roll on the cello. Thank you for helping all of us artists out here in the Bay Area, and we so appreciate this show and everything you're doing.
Yes, we appreciate you, Nathan, and our Kick Aspirin show. Thank you, Nathan, so much. Thank you, Donato. Always good to see you, Nathan. You better come back and answer my email more quickly so you can come back. We can do a full interview. All right, everybody. I've been chatting with conductor Donato Cabrera and cellist Nathan Chan. See them in the California Symphony Concert, Schubert in Vienna, and that's happening at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek on January 24th and 25th. All right, that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sound Show with me, Janae Darden. Congested Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. Just a reminder, I have a great poetry reading and discussion coming up with award-winning poet James Cagney. We'll be talking about his new book, Ghetto Koans, A Personal Archive, and that'll be at Books, Inc. in Alameda on Thursday, January 22nd at 7 p.m. And you can go to booksinc.net for details. We'll have a link on the Sights and Sounds page. Make sure you check out singer Deanna Gameros. She'll be performing tomorrow night at the Oakland Museum. Definitely check her out. She's a friend to the show. Writer Tomi Adeyemi is the author of the best-selling novel Children of Blood and Bone, and she will be at the San Francisco Public Library this Sunday. And I just want to acknowledge some people who have become ancestors. Rest in peace to the great Oakland poet Nellie Wong. Rest in peace to Marcelo Aviles. Forgive me if I mispronounce his name. He's the director of programming at the Yerba Buena Gardens Festival. And rest in peace to Bob Weir. All right, we'll have another great show for you. And he co-founded the Grateful Dead. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Be good to yourselves and each other.